Welcome to the video podcast, Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed, where truth and unity matter. Take the deep dive with highly influential voices in and around the 9/11 truth movement.
And welcome everybody to Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed once again. Great to have you here. It's been quite a week. We have been busy as beavers. Gail and I, and I'll introduce you to Gail in just a second. In fact, I will introduce you to my wonderful wife, Gail, right now. Gail, how are you doing?
Hi, Richard and everybody. I am doing wonderful. Thank you. Wonderful Saturday morning.
Great. What's it been like for you, Gail, before we get to our exciting guest tonight? For the last week on RichardGage911.org and Richard Gage, a lot of Richard Gages here, huh? it's the name of our company, too, our limited liability company, Richard Gage 911, Richard Gage AIA Architect. Because you and I have been launched with this new company, and you helping me every night after you come home from work, we have been launched as a result of being booted out of the nest of AE 9/11 Truth, which you may be aware of by now. You may not. I am independent of AE 9/11 Truth, and I am stretching my wings, and we're flying solo. Now, in parallel, a double punch to the wall of denial out there of the 9/11 truth. And there's going to be no greater punch to that wall than our guest today, Kevin Ryan, whom I'll introduce in a moment. But Gail, let's see what have you actually been doing to help out here, because it's been a lot and people don't know. You're largely behind the scenes, and I want them to know what you do. So just give us a real brief summary of the activities that make our new venture here possible.
All right. Well, there's probably a lot that I'm going to miss, but one of the things that I'm doing is with the podcast, everybody that pretty much already knows, is I'm watching for questions to come across through StreamYard to be able to put them in the private chat for Richard and then read the questions and give him the answers so people can answer. And I'm also taking all of the guest speakers that we're going to be having on the podcast, as well as interviews that Richard is going to be doing as they get scheduled, putting them on our calendar. So we have one private calendar, and then it gets transferred over to the public calendar so that it can be uploaded to the website.
And what website? Tell them about that.
Richard Gage, AIA 911.
No. You know the website. RichardGage911.org.
Sorry, I stuck the AIA in there. Yes.
I do that all the time, too.
So, yes. And then also a lot of social media filtering and looking for comments that people make that we can use to put on the website in our testimonials. And I'm also working on establishing some tasks that our wonderful volunteers, people that are volunteering to help us, we've actually had quite a few, and some of them have a lot of skills and experience that we can use. And so I'm working on putting together sort of a list that we can use for the people with the different skills, and then contacting them, which hopefully will happen today. Yes.
Let's see what else. So how do they find the volunteer form if people want to volunteer?
You go to the website, and there is a place, I believe it's under
Actions.
Thank you. And there's a volunteer form. Just click on it, and you can fill out the form, put all your personal, the information that we need, as well as what you would like to volunteer for, your skill set that you have that we could use possibly. And it's awesome because several people are just saying, hey, I just want to help do anything that you have need of. I want to help you.
Yeah, that's been incredible to see that response. Also, we want to remind people to support the effort here. And how do they do that?
Well, you go to the website, and there's several places there that you'll see where it says support. And it's
and
through Substack, support and subscribe. And it gives you different options of either entering an amount that you would like to choose yourself, or you can do a one-time donation of any amount that you'd like. There's also options for $7 a month or is it $300 a year. So there's different options.
We're now up to about $700 per month in terms of of what's coming in, and that's good. That's a great start. It in fact pays about a third of my mortgage. So we don't know when our last paycheck will be here from AE 911 Truth. They're going to be there's open questions about how that's all going to work. So folks, if you want me to continue interviewing incredible guests like Kevin Ryan, it's a lot of work, actually, I found out, to schedule and commit to bringing these amazing guests that we have next week after Kevin is Captain Dan Hanley of the 9/11 pilot whistleblowers. So we've got to have your support. So please visit the website, RichardGage911.org, punch the donate button and take it from there. You can make a one-time donation. You can donate monthly. We are so grateful. You can even send in a check. There's a place where you can do that. So very, very grateful to you for that. We're going to let Gail go and bring on our guest here. Thank you so much for visiting us, Gail. And you'll be back there taking questions, right? So if you have a question on Facebook or on YouTube, write it down there in the chat, and Gail will scrape it and bring it to our guest after our dialogue today. That sound good, Gail?
Sounds wonderful. I'll be ready the questions.
All right. We'll see you in a minute. Let's see. I want to introduce you to our wonderful guests. I mean, we're talking today about demolition access to the World Trade Center and the 9/11 suspects over at AE 9/11 Truth. I avoided topics like our guest today is going to be putting right here in our face, the obvious, the elephant in the room, whodunit. Now, he's not saying whodunit. He's saying, hey, take a look at these interesting individuals and take a look at the access to the towers. After all, who could have placed explosives in the World Trade Center towers? AE 911 Truth, of which I was the CEO for 15 years and now I'm acting independently. But while I was there, we assembled a vast body of proof that the World Trade Center skyscrapers, all three of them, were brought down by explosive demolition. So that body of evidence has been put out there. It's in our webinars. There's 5 hours of webinar, hundreds of them on YouTube right now. You can visit, you can search on YouTube for 9/11 and Architect's Guide. And there's three series. Part one is the World Trade Center Building 7. Part two is the Twin Towers. Part three is the Twin Towers in extreme heat. Part two was the Twin Towers and very explosive destruction. So using that as a base for today's discussion, we want to answer the question, who could have placed the explosives? So we should first consider, Kevin says, who had access to the buildings, specifically the areas of the buildings that would be relevant to a demolition operation and when that access was available to them. Those who had access at the necessary times should be further considered in terms of their ability to obtain the necessary explosive technologies and expertise, their ability to be secretive, and the possibility that they could have benefited from the destruction of the World Trade Center buildings or from the resulting war on terror, $6.5 trillion war on terror. The same questions can be asked about the 9/11 crimes overall, including the failure to defend the skies, for instance. In this hour, we'll discuss some answers to these questions that could help us move closer to understanding who committed the crimes of 9/11. Now, as site manager for the Environmental Testing Division of Underwriter Laboratories, Kevin began investigating the tragedy of September 11th, 2001. UL fired Kevin in 2004 for publicly asking questions about the company's fire resistance testing of the structural materials used to build the World Trade Center buildings, as well as UL's involvement in the WTC investigation being conducted by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Since 2006, Kevin has been an editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies and founding member of several action groups. He also served as a board of directors of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and co-authored several books and numerous peer-reviewed scientific articles on the subject, which we'll be looking at today as well a little bit. Kevin has given public presentations around the country and continues to do research into the crimes of 9/11 in order to help people come to a better understanding. Now, having said all of that, let's bring on our guest, Mr. Kevin Ryan. Kevin, how you doing?
Hi, Richard. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, fantastic to be with you. Kevin, tell us first how you got in your very first kind of awakening to what really happened at 9/11 and when that was.
Yeah, this was in 2003. And I was woken up first by lies about the weapons of mass destruction that were occurring that year as justification for the invasion of Iraq. So it really did. It took me almost 2 years to really figure out that something was wrong with 9/11. So people who still to this day, now 20 years later, really haven't accepted that there is something wrong, that 9/11 was a deception, shouldn't feel bad. You know, most of us took some time to figure it out. But yeah, 2003 was when I started to realize that there was something terribly wrong and that our leaders were willing to lie to do really just atrocious things in order to drive their agenda. And so the weapons of mass destruction led me to start reading about 9/11 questions, which were widely available on the internet back then at that time. And also when I started to realize there were all these questions, I started to remember that the CEO of my company, Underwriters Laboratories, had come to our location in 2001, just 2 weeks after the 9/11 crimes, and told us that the company had certified the steel components used to build the World Trade Center for fire resistance. And so this wasn't a huge surprise to anybody, because that's one of the things that UL does, is test materials for safety, including fire resistance. And so,
by the way, Kevin, we relied on those tests as architects all the time. We use those specifications that they help write, and it's an extraordinary service they perform. It's universal across almost all buildings. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. They publish a fire resistance directory and basically regularly. And so it really wasn't a big surprise, although my company, when I ended up speaking out about it and causing a big hullabaloo about it, you know, they started to say things like there's no evidence that UL had tested the structural components used to build the World Trade Center. They didn't deny that they did it. They said there's no evidence. So there actually was quite a bit of evidence, including the fact that the fire resistance directory had the components in them. And that includes for World Trade Center Building 7. So my company was also, at the time I worked there, engaged in helping the investigation being conducted by NIST, as you said. And so they had built some model floor assemblies, and they had put these in a furnace and conducted the test ASTM E119, which is the test that was used to see if structural components would bear their load under huge thermal conditions in the furnace. And those tests failed in August 2004 to show that the floor assemblies would have failed. So the important thing here is that UL had certified the column assemblies and the floor assemblies and shown that they would not fail under more intense fire and by the New York City Code of 1968 at the time. And that was for several hours in each case, whereas I think we both know the South Tower only lasted for 56 minutes. So that's a glaring question right there in terms of just the safety of the structure.
Yeah. And what about the fireproofing on those tests? Comparable to what NIST says happened to the fireproofing.
Yeah, that's a good point. So that was what they really wanted to lean on back at the time. You probably remember the pancake theory, which was the theory that the floors had lost their strength and had started sagging and then collapsed into a pancake. This was being promoted by Popular Mechanics and really discussed widely in the media as the main theory for how the buildings, the towers had failed. And so UL had built these models of floor assemblies to test and provide some evidence for that. And they built several models, some of which they stripped off all the fireproofing and conducted the test. And still, after using no fireproofing, and frankly, as stated in the reports, twice the load that would have been seen in the World Trade Center buildings, the floors would still not fail. They would not sag. They sagged in some cases a couple of inches, and then in this computer, that couple of inches became 42 inches. And so these things just stood out in the report. And, you know, the additional tests for how hot the steel got showed very low temperatures, around 250 degrees Celsius. And so I started speaking out about that publicly, and that's when UL fired me for doing so. And it's been a journey since then, as you know. It's a journey for yourself. And you know, frankly, I'm here to support you, Richard, because I see you as not only somebody who shared a mission with me for many years, but as somebody who has now, frankly, been fired for doing the right thing. We won't go into what that was. But to me, you were fired for doing the right thing. And so I want to support you. I hope you have a great next step in your journey.
Oh, I appreciate that so much, Kevin. I'm not so sure I did the right thing. For those who don't know what we're referring to here, I did in a hallway interview, somebody stuck a microphone in my face at a conspiracy conference, which we speak at all the time. But in this case, at the Red Pill Expo, they were specifically talking about that disease that's going around and exposing a lot of very interesting information about it, which really kind of angered me, like the truth about 9/11 angered me 15 years ago when I woke up about it myself. You beat me by 2 years, Kevin, 3 years. Way to go. But then I spoke inadvisedly about it. And as a result, Spike Lee, who had interviewed me for 2 hours and was going to put a half hour segment of that on HBO, we lost that opportunity because he pulled it because Slate Magazine put in his face these comments. And Spike Lee was invested in the official narrative of this disease going around. So he felt it undermined his own efforts in the earlier part of his four-part Epicenter series, miniseries on HBO. So we lost the best opportunity we had ever had in the 9/11 Truth Movement. It was an epic loss for all of us. Millions and millions would have seen the truth about 9/11. And I'm quite convinced that was the reason Spike Lee pulled that 30-minute segment. And so as a result, our PR expert convinced our board that this was a major PR crisis and that the CEO had to go. So there was quite an argument and off I went. So that's the short version. The detailed version is in a letter on my website, richardgage911.org. And so that's what Kevin's referring to here, having also gotten fired for saying the wrong or right thing, you decide yourself. In Kevin's case, certainly the right thing. In my case, questionable, because I wish I hadn't said that. I wish I wasn't fired. I'm glad that I'm stretching my wings, and you've been stretching yours too, Kevin. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I definitely have been stretching my wings. You know, my journey in trying to reveal the truth about 9/11 has been a really great personal growth number of years. So, you know, it's been 18 years for me now. And you know, in that time, after being fired, I began doing a lot of research. And, you know, I had some time on my hands immediately afterward. And I started going to university libraries, and I was able to find a lot of information that was useful in helping me to understand what might have happened and what didn't happen on 9/11. And, you know, I started doing research along with some people who I met along the way, and some of those may be your guests eventually. For example, Dr. Stephen Jones from Brigham Young University was someone who began to speak out in 2005, and you know, he had read some of my some of the things that I'd said, and he agreed with me in his paper, "Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Buildings Collapse," which was an article that really pulled together a lot of what people had been saying a little bit about thermite. You know, there was already some discussion about thermite being the reason why the some of the high temperatures were seen, some molten metal was seen flowing from the buildings. And Stephen Jones kind of pulled that together into a really seminal article called "Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Buildings Collapse?" And that got him in some hot water as well, eventually, and also his additional work in pursuing those questions. But yeah, we worked together, along with some others. And we did some research. We initiated the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which now has 150 peer-reviewed articles covering a broad range of subjects related to 9/11. We also published a number of peer-reviewed scientific articles in mainstream scientific journals, a Journal of Chemical Physics, a Journal of Civil Engineering, and an environmental science journal. We published articles that provided evidence that there was actually evidence for the thermite reaction going on at the World Trade Center and residues of thermitic materials in the World Trade Center dust. And so, you know, that was an exciting time up to 2009 when we published those articles. In 2009, after that had all been established and through the work of people like yourself and others, I think had fully established that the official accounts were wrong. And not only that, that there's evidence that for example, the World Trade Center buildings were brought down through explosive demolition. And so, what occurred to me was we'd done such a good job of that, but nobody was really taking the next step in a convincing way to find out who might have actually done these things and who was in position to do these things and who benefited and answering those questions. So I began to ask those questions, and I began to write articles related to who could have put explosives in the World Trade Center buildings. So I wrote a series of articles that's known as Demolition Access to the World Trade Center. There's actually four articles in that series. And you can find those at 911truth.org, at 911review.com, for example.
And can you name those articles, all four of them, or at least the subject matter for us? So we know we're talking about the first article today, but name that and the other three as well before we jump into the first one.
Yeah, the first one's called Demolition Access to the World Trade Center Towers, Part One, Tenants. And so, you know, that looked at who occupied the buildings. Part two was Demolition Access to the World Trade Center Towers, Part Two, Security, talked about security companies. Part three talked about a convergence of certain companies that had a lot in common and had a lot of means to make things happen. SAIC, Carlyle Group, Kissinger, and Halliburton. Mm. And then the fourth one was about Demolition Access to the World Trade Center Towers, Part Four, the cleanup. And so it talked about the people who mysteriously removed the evidence in a rapid manner and had it all recycled before it could be examined appropriately. So that's the series of articles.
So let me just stop you for a second. Let's take a poll of our live listeners here. And you can make comments if you're listening later after the live stream. How many of you would like to have Kevin back to talk about part 2, 3, and 4 after we get part 1? Let us know as Kevin develops his thesis, if you will, for part 1. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, so part 1 is about tenets. And so I did a thorough examination. These are long articles. You have to have some time to sit down and read. But the first one was received very well among people who are interested in the subject. And so I just looked through, who occupied all the floors. As particular, I'm looking at floors that were related to the impact of the planes, floors that were related to the fires and the failure that occurred. Also, you know, I think, Richard, you've also mentioned this quite a bit in your time, access to the elevators. Particularly, there was a company called Ace Elevator that had an elevator upgrade project going on the years before 9/11. And so I looked at all of that. But really, one thing that drew my attention in 2008 was a strange correlation between the fireproofing upgrades that were going on in the few years before 9/11 and where they occurred. And it turned out, you know, I drew a diagram of this kind of showing that where the fireproofing upgrades occurred just happened to be exactly where the planes impacted, exactly where these weird fires were occurring. And they matched up perfectly. I mean, in the North Tower, it was exact. It was exact. So the,
wow.
The floors 92 to 100, for example, were upgraded for fireproofing. That's exactly where the plane hit the building. Those floors were all occupied by a company called Marsh & McLennan. And Marsh & McLennan was this huge conglomerate. It had various insurance and other financial interests. And one of the employees for Marsh & McLennan drew my attention. He actually had an office in the South Tower. So he wasn't actually at the office that day. He miraculously survived. But this is a guy that people know. His name is L. Paul Bremer. And L. Paul Bremer was a longtime expert on terrorism back to his days as managing director of Kissinger Associates. And then later leading several commissions investigating the official myths of terrorism, Al-Qaeda and such. But on 9/11, L. Paul Bremer was the head of Marsh Crisis. So basically a division of Marsh that prepared for, well, frankly, exactly these kinds of events. And so it was very interesting to me that this Marsh & McLennan occupied all the floors that were exactly where the fireproofing upgrade has occurred on the North Tower. And one of their executives had an office in the South Tower. And you may remember that on the day of 9/11, it was L. Paul Bremer who showed up on the news telling us exactly what happened. He knew the whole story. It was Osama bin Laden. You know, the buildings couldn't withstand the stress and such. And so we had to go after Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And, just remarkable, you know. But other things about Bremer that drew my attention was he was a director of some interesting companies, including one that had patented a thermite demolition device.
Oh.
So yeah, it was a subsidiary of Dresser Industries. If you remember Dresser Industries, this was a company that George H.W. Bush had worked with in his days as a CIA business asset. So it's basically a CIA business company, Dresser Industries, related to the oil and gas industry. But Komatsu Dresser, which is a construction subsidiary of Dresser, had Bremer on its board, and also they had patented a thermite demolition device in 1998. So these things just start to adding up to me with, you know, suspicion. At this point, there are a lot of just strings, you know, coming together, things pulling together. not necessarily saying that L. Paul Bremer planted explosives in the World Trade Center, but, you know, frankly, it's very suspicious that the company would occupy the exact floors that were fireproofing upgrades occurred and where the plane crashed. And their executive, who didn't show up at the office, ended up telling us what happened on TV that day. People may know L. Paul Bremer better as being the occupation governor of Iraq. So he worked for Donald Rumsfeld right after that period of time. And he was instilled as the governor of Iraq under occupation.
An incredible series of coincidences. Yeah. Well, by the way, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, who's looking not only and has given 60 exhibits of the evidence that we have all in the 9/11 truth movement put together over the last 15 to 20 years, that's been given to the Attorney General in Manhattan to give to a special grand jury investigation. And I, as a plaintiff, among others, have sued with the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry's facilitation, the Attorney General to force them in a mandamus action to reveal that they've actually given this material over. And the supplement to this is a series of individuals. A supplement to the petition includes a series of individuals from your book, Another 19, chief among which I think is L. Paul Bremer. And I just want you to know that I heard from the other day from Mick Harrison at Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, who is the chief litigation director, that even though this has been going on now for 2 years, this is normal. He's won lawsuits that have been in for 7 to 10 years in the legal mumbo, limbo, it seems, but these things work themselves out. And so, you know, L. Paul Bremer could very well be subpoenaed here as a result of the suggestions of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, which is a result of your excellent work in your book, Another 19. So rest assured that there will be fruits of your hard work.
That's great. You know, and I just want to take that this minute, because you mentioned the Lawyers Committee, which I presented for in their event on the 20th anniversary not long ago. I just wanted to mention we could someone who could use support. His name is David Meiswinkel. Mm-hmm. And David was the executive director of the Lawyers Committee until very recently, and was again let go in a similar thing that happened as happened to you. Now, I know you're on the board, but the fact is that David was really the voice and the driver of the 9/11 Lawyers Committee for many years. And I would just encourage people to support David. You could find him on the web still. And from there, you know, we can talk more about the tenants or the Bremer has some very, very interesting connections to others who are suspects in my book. One of them being Brian Michael Jenkins, who I wrote an article kind of explaining how Bremer and Jenkins were really the drivers of the official myth of Al-Qaeda in the years before 9/11. And then they both showed up basically at the World Trade Center in different ways. Bremer, of course, because he had an office there in the South Tower. And Brian Michael Jenkins, because of his work as the director of Kroll and Kroll Associates. You may know that company, Kroll Associates. I think you're aware of people like Jerome Hauer, who worked for Kroll Associates. But Brian Michael Jenkins, as a guy who had a long history of, again, being kind of the guy, one of the people telling us where the terrorism was, who the problem was. You know, and it just happened to be in these countries that we were planning to invade. But Jenkins, more than that, over the years, was accused himself of terrorism in Central America. And the reason I feel like he's connected to the World Trade Center strongly is that he was the leader of the Kroll Associates group that did an analysis after the 1993 bombing of World Trade Center into what the risks were to the World Trade Center towers, particularly. And so, you know, he evaluated, and it's publicly known, he evaluated the impact of an airliner into the buildings and what would occur. And then the security systems, which would be part two of the Demolition Access series, but the security systems were designed then around what Brian Michael Jenkins came up with and in protecting the towers from that sort of event. And it just happened to occur. So, you know, when we talk about Bremer and Jenkins, we're talking about the guys who gave us basically the myth behind Al-Qaeda. And then they showed up in different important ways at the World Trade Center. And some of them were Jenkins has been accused of terrorism himself in the past. They just lead to a lot of suspicion. And as you said at the beginning, Richard, you know, I'm not saying these people did these crimes. I'm saying they need to be investigated. You know, that's what we need to do. We need to direct our attention to specific people who have a lot of strange coincidences in their connections to 9/11. And,
well, and that's the grand jury's job is to find out if crimes have been committed and then to investigate possible sources so that they can issue indictments. That's not our job. It's certainly not your job. It's not even the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry's job. We're just providing sources that they can subpoena and ask questions to. So
absolutely.
We're not saying who done it here.
No. We're saying these 19 people in the book, Another 19, had the means, the motive, and the opportunity. We can say that. Mm-hmm. We can also say that they're much more likely to have accomplished the crimes than the 19 alleged hijackers who were accused, right? Yeah. They had the power and they had the motivation and the means. So that's what the book is about. It's specifically about 19 because, as I'm sure you remember, you know, when we first were asking a lot of questions about 9/11, people would say, oh, that couldn't happen. You know, it would have to be a vast conspiracy, totally ignoring the fact that the official account is a conspiracy theory itself. But it's a conspiracy theory involving 19 alleged hijackers and just a couple of others, Osama bin Laden, for example. And so my book is providing, you know, you get around the whole vast conspiracy thing by saying, OK, here's another 19. Unless you're a monstrous racist or something, frankly, you would at least look at these other 19 and say, you know, yeah, they weren't Muslims. They were white guys in ties and they were all Americans. Now, I'm not saying that another criticism I have, frankly, is that, you know, I don't point the finger at a specific country other than basically elements within our own country, which I believe is where we need to start. As Americans, we need to ask, how could our huge multi-trillion dollar defense system be overcome so easily? How could buildings be wired for explosives? And, you know, it wasn't these 5.5 foot tall Arab guys. It wasn't them. They couldn't have put explosives in the World Trade Center. They could barely fly planes. They could barely fly small planes. So we need to find out who it was, and that's what this investigation is all about.
Yeah, excellent. Now, regarding the fireproofing upgrade, since you mentioned that stunning coincidence between where the planes hit, which is a different set of floors, 15 stories down in the case of the North Tower, 30 stories down in the case of the South Tower, but 5 or 6 or 7 floors above and below where the planes hit is exactly where fireproofing upgrades happen. So I just wanted to divert you back to that for a quick question. What possible scenario could account between fireproofing upgrades on those floors and the resulting destruction of the building? Because fireproofing is supposed to protect the building from fire, not start or aid fires. So can you explain that?
Yeah, and I just wanted to mention that, you know, really the correlation is pretty exact. It's not as exact for the South Tower, but for the North Tower, it's precisely exact. So the floors that were upgraded were 92 through 100. That's where the plane hit. And those are all occupied by Marshall McLennan. And then, you know, in the South Tower, 77 and 78 were fireproofing upgraded, and 83. And those floors were occupied by, 77 and 78 of the South Tower were occupied by a company called Baseline Financial. And were led by a mysterious guy named Joseph Casputis. So, you know, he had ties to the intelligence world and financial world. And so, you know, the reason fireproofing upgrades are so important is because that allowed the structural steel to be revealed. You know, in order to do the fireproofing upgrades, you had to uncover the structural steel. And so, you know, what could have been done at, you know, in order to facilitate the crimes of 9/11 by removing the fireproofing and upgrading the fireproofing on the steel. Well, you know, one thing that many of us believe is true is that the planes were in fact hijacked. They were hijacked remotely, and that, you know, the planes were then flew into their targets remotely by military capable people who were using what was then proven technology. I mean, they could fly a large airliner by remote control technology into an exact location. And that was being shown. I think one researcher who's done a lot of work, you may invite him eventually on this, is Aidan Monahan. And he did a lot of good work in investigating the technologies related to this remote control of these large airliners. But, you know, if there needed to be beacons, for example, placed in the buildings in places where people wouldn't know where they were, that's an example of what fireproofing upgrades could have allowed. Another thing would be the application of particularly nanothermite type materials. So, you know, nanothermite, something that I've made myself in my own garage, and it's not easy to make. It's difficult to make, but if you get the right components together and you follow a formulation, which is formulations are published, for example, by the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. I made some based on one of their formulations. And, you know, this is a sol gel material. So back in the early years, you know, we wondered about how the material, how thermite could have been applied if it was applied. And in some cases, we feel like it was applied through a sol gel coating. And so sol gel is the basis for nanothermite formulations in many cases. And so, you know, applying this material under the fireproofing, for example, is an example of what could have been done. Oh. And yeah, so, you know, I think people misunderstand that to mean that we feel like nanothermite was the only explosive or incendiary material used in the World Trade Center. That's not what any of us have ever said that they're aware of. And so really we feel like explosives were placed throughout the buildings, but thermite materials were placed in specific locations. So the core columns needed to be weakened. They were huge, massive columns, and they needed to be weakened. So thermite is an example of what could do that. And then also fires needed to occur beyond the time that they would have actually occurred. So if people haven't thought about this, you know, explosions like a jet fuel fire impact explosion is something that consumes all the oxygen in the area. And basically everybody, including the government, if you don't know, agree that the jet fuel fires burned off in just a couple of minutes. So jet fuel fires were not what caused the World Trade Center to.
Well, even NIST acknowledges that the jet fuel burned up, they say it in 10 minutes, most of it burned up outside, 90% of it burned up outside the buildings, they said, and the rest of it was gone in 10 minutes. So for the next hour or hour and a half, you have normal office fires that were lit by jet fuel, which is essentially kerosene, right?
Exactly. So this is the thing. The fires, though, you know, they went out. So if you remember in the 1993 invasion of Iraq, the way Saddam Hussein retreated was he set all the oil wells on fire. And just stay with me here for a minute. But the way we put them out is the way people put them out was let explosives off at the point of the fire, because explosives would consume all the oxygen, and then the fires would go out. And the jet fuel explosions at the World Trade Center did the same thing. And if you watch over time, the buildings burning, the fires actually went out almost. They went very, very low after the jet, after the plane impact. But then they started up again and they raged. They actually raged around the buildings. And then the points opposite impact, they were raging fires again. So, you know, how could that happen? In my opinion, you know, people didn't intend to just demolish the World Trade Center buildings. I think that's clear. They intended to provide a psychological trauma to people. They intended to provide a show that would stay with people. And that required fire to continue. In my opinion, nanothermite, one of the uses of nanothermite was in those areas where they needed fire to continue. They needed to show on TV that fires were burning when really they didn't have enough fire load on those floors for it to burn very long. And but nanothermite would have burned. It would have melted steel. We saw molten metal falling from the buildings, as you've shown many times before. And so the application of this nanothermite in those areas, I think, was part of how that happened.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. Now, you mentioned that nanothermite or thermite and or thermite were not, probably not the only technologies. And I agree with you. And I just wanted to add that we have eight ton structural steel sections ejected laterally out of the towers at 80 miles an hour, clocked by physicists, landing 600 feet in every direction. This is an incredible explosive force. And we've always been saying that there's most likely high energy explosives. And yet we keep getting criticized by a small element of the 9/11 truth community for exaggerating the explosiveness of thermite or nanothermite when, like you said, this is not our only thesis. And I have told some of these people personally several times that this is a straw man attack against those of us who are exposing the forensic evidence of thermite. Do you have any other comments on that issue?
Well, yeah, you know, we see a lot of the straw man attacks, you know, people who try to present our information as claims in specific ways. And, you know, that has gone on for years, ever since I've been involved. And it's a misdirection. And, you know, frankly, it just causes more confusion and doesn't help. But I think that's the intention in some cases. So, I've never said that nanothermite was the only thing used to bring down the World Trade Centers. I don't believe that at all. I believe that molecular explosives like HMX, for example, were also used. And, you know, people ask, well, you've tested the World Trade Center dust for the thermitic materials. We have found thermitic materials scattered throughout the World Trade Center dust. Has anybody tested the World Trade Center dust for residues from explosive materials? And I can say that I have not done that. I think it's possible to do that. I don't know what the outcome would be.
Well, let me say this. NIST actually said that they found no residue of explosives in the World Trade Center dust or steel. And a year later, they acknowledge in writing that they never looked for it.
Right. So they admitted after they said that no, we didn't actually test for it. Of course, you're not going to find what you don't test for.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's possible to do chromatography testing, for example, of World Trade Center dust samples and possibly find trace amounts of residues from molecular explosives, although it may not be possible as well.
Can you explain molecular explosives versus high energy explosives?
Right. So I call them molecular explosives. So like HMX, for example, is an example of what I would call molecular explosive. But, you know, there's high tech technology that, you know, the national laboratories and military had been examining at the time. But, you know, one thing about access to the World Trade Center towers in terms of demolition. You know, there are other kind of red herring stories, I believe, that relate to, you know, kind of hint at the idea that somebody was there putting explosives in. For example, they talk about moving vans running around the area, and maybe they had bunches of explosives who came that day and planted them all. And, you know, I just, you know, it's the placement of explosives for demolition. I think, Richard, you could maybe be able to speak better than I can about this after all these years. It doesn't occur overnight. It's not something that happens on the weekend. There may be some final touches, and we've talked about power outages in the days or weeks before 9/11. There may be some final touches, but to actually wire buildings or prepare them for demolition takes quite a long time, and especially huge towers like the ones that fell down on 9/11.
Excellent point. Now, did I divert you from your suspects and the tenants in the World Trade Center? If you want to continue with that line of thinking, yeah, we'd love to hear more.
Well, if you read the article, I go through pretty much all the floors. You know, the tenants were well known and published, and looked at all of them very well, very much examining them closely. And, you know, the Marshall McLennan connection, I think, is one that needs to be followed up on. There was another, there's another whistleblower. I want to say his name is Richard as well. Richard Grove, perhaps. From Marshall McLennan, who talked about financial crimes that he revealed related to 9/11. So I think Marshall McLennan is a great key link, and L. Paul Bremer, one of their executives, is part of that. I also think, as I mentioned, Joseph Kasputis of Baseline Financial occupied the floors that were upgraded for fireproofing in the South Tower, the lowest floors. There's another company similar to Marshall McLennan, a competitor of theirs called Aon Corporation, that occupied floor 83 of the South Tower. And that's another floor that's closely related to these fireproofing upgrades and the impact zones. So those are two or three companies that could be looked into. You know, throughout the buildings, though, explosives would have to be placed, not just at the impact zones. And so I go through all the floors and talk about the different tenants. I don't have all of it in memory, and it's hard to just read from an article in an interview. But I looked at some of these throughout the buildings, and there's definitely some good candidates for people who might have known something and might have been involved in some way. But at the same time, when we get to the second article, we go into security. I think there's even more possibilities there, because people who controlled security controlled access to all the areas and could prevent access where it wasn't needed or wasn't wanted, and give access when it wasn't needed, whenever it was needed. So in conjunction with these upgrades to the buildings, whether they be the elevator upgrades or the fireproofing upgrades of the floors, I think some combination of those activities and events would explain how explosives could have been placed in the buildings.
Well, the elevator upgrades, this was the largest elevator modernization in history. And all of the elevators were upgraded by a company who didn't install or maintain those elevators for the life of that building, but a new company that came out of nowhere, Ace Elevator, as you mentioned. And so some have been alarmed that, the USA Today acknowledged that these employees who were in the building at the time of the airplane impacts fled. They didn't stick around and help the firefighters to rescue these victims. Do you know more about that?
Absolutely. That's a great example of why Ace Elevator is, again, a suspect, because, as you said, the elevator mechanics fled the scene, and that is not what they do. And in fact, they're required to stay. It's kind of a professional must do. You know, when there's a fire or there's a problem with the building, the elevator mechanics are very likely to be needed because of elevator failure during that sort of event. And so elevator mechanics always stay and help out when they're available. In this case, all of the ACE elevator employees flew from the building. They fled inexplicably, and there were articles written about why, not explaining why, but explaining that they did and how it was so unusual. So
it was a scandal.
I looked into the owner of ACE Elevator, and his name escapes me a little bit, starts with a B. But it's kind of a mysterious company. It shut down not long after 9/11. That's similar to a lot of the things that happen with these suspicious companies. You know, when we get to security, we'll talk about companies that just folded after 9/11, went bankrupt, and never were heard from again. And it's similar with ACE Elevator. So, you know, looking at them, I think that, in my opinion, and I'd have to go back and dig up the details, but in my opinion, ACE Elevator had links to organized crime. And I think that that's partly how they get people to do things without saying anything. You know, how could they be? We talked about who could keep a secret, who could be secret through all this. Well, if you're a member of organized crime or associated with them, and you know what they'll do to you if you say anything, you're not going to say anything. And so, you know, there's a lot of links to organized crime in the cleanup of the World Trade Center as well. You know, Giuliani hired a lot of organized crime-linked cleanup workers. And so, you know, if we're trying to remove evidence and not say anything, or whatever you might find you're not going to say anything about, then if you're associated with organized crime, I think that's an example of how it could be explained.
Yeah. Where can people find those other three essays in which you describe the security, the convergence, and the cleanup links here?
The security, part two, the security, demolition access to the World Trade Center, can be found at 911truth.org. I feel like they've got the best, cleanest formatting of the article.
Oh.
Then the next two, part three and part four, are also found on 911review.com, which is a Jim Hoffman site. You know, Jim Hoffman is one of the forerunners of all of us who put together a lot of important information and led people like myself and Jim and Stephen Jones and yourself, I think, as well, to understand a lot more about 9/11. So he's got the 9/11 research website, which is huge wealth of information. And he's also got 911review.com, which posts a lot of articles, including these demolition access articles.
Beautiful, beautiful. And tell us about the dig within site. In fact, I have it right here. Let's see if I can share that with our folks. I will do that right now. And there it is here.
Yeah. So digwithin.net is my personal blog. And I think we mentioned the Journal of 911studies.com. So Journal of 911studies.com is where that journal is at. This is my personal blog where I write basically whatever I want, Richard, because, you know, like you, I'm no longer leashed, or have never really been leashed. If you want to start your own blog, Richard, I'd be happy to read it. But, you know, I started my own blog after doing a lot of blogging at 9/11 Blogger and writing a lot of articles. I'd written tons of articles before I started this blog in 2011. And since then, I've written on all subjects related to 9/11 and a lot of other things. So you can, it's a WordPress blog. So basically, you can find articles by title. You can find them by the date they were published. And in some cases, you can find by kind of the subject keywords, if you link on the keywords, categories, I think they're called down at the bottom. So, and people leave comments for me occasionally. I don't have a lot of time to manage the comments. It's really not intended to be a chat room. It's intended to be a blog, but I will interact a little bit on that. You've got one here called Experiments with Nanothermite. This is an example of a video, and I'm not good with videos, frankly, but But I did film a description of how I prepared some nanothermite, and that's what this video is about. One of the more recent ones you can see is about carbon nanotubes. This is another feature of our research, particularly Dr. Niels Herrett and myself have looked into carbon nanotubes scattered throughout the World Trade Center dust, along with the thermitic materials. But the reason carbon nanotubes are such an important thing is that they've been found in 9/11 first responder lung tissue. And that was an inexplicable and surprising finding by these medical researchers. I've been in touch with actually the lead research a researcher related to carbon nanotubes at the Mount Sinai Hospital. And she agreed that this was very interesting. So what I did here is I posted an excerpt of Dr. Herrett's presentation at the Toronto hearings, where he explains, you know, how carbon nanotubes are prepared and why it's so important that they were found in first responder lung tissue and now also in World Trade Center dust. So we found them in World Trade Center dust, and we had that independently verified by an independent laboratory by sending samples of residue out to the independent laboratory. And so in this blog post, I described that. And that research, again, needs to be followed up. So there's another great avenue here to not only find out more about what happened on 9/11, but to help, in some cases, maybe some of these people who are still suffering from these unusual diseases, cancers and other things who served the public at the site at Ground Zero. And so this is a great article to take a look at 9/11 related subjects that's more recent. I think the most recent article I published was a review of the film 7 that was basically the story of Leroy Halsey at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And so, you know, I haven't been doing a great deal of writing lately, but I have been reviewing films and reviewing books. And this movie 7, I feel, is a great story that tells these how these this structural engineer and his academic and co-workers did a thorough investigation of how World Trade Center 7 might have collapsed and found that, you know, it could not have been the way that NIST explained that the building collapsed. So, you know, in direct contradiction, their findings, an academic study in direct contradiction, as you well know, Richard. And so the film covers that story and I reviewed it. But if I had to guess how many articles are at my blog, I would guess, you know, it's probably 150 again, over 100.
That means we have to have you back 100 times because we got to get into all this stuff. But we got time. This is going to be a long haul, isn't it, Kevin? Apparently, it is it's been 20 years already.
It is a long haul. And, you know, for me, it's not a career. It's not how I make a living. But, you know, just on your behalf, Richard, I would say, I used to be a board director at Architects and Engineers. And for people who think that Richard's making a ton of money on 9/11, I can tell you he isn't. He wasn't. I know I know how much he made in that job, and I'm pretty sure that he could have made a lot more as a practicing architect. You know, it's not about making money; it's about doing the right thing and making yourself available to do that. So I support, you know, what you're doing, Richard. I hope you continue on and don't get downhearted about it.
Thank you.
And Gail is great support from what I hear and can see.
Well, speaking of the lovely lady, let's see. It looks like she might have been collecting some questions for you from the audience. Is that right, Gail?
Yes, I sure have been.
Oh, good. Well, let's hear some of them, or at least one at a time.
All right. This first one is from Joseph. He very sweetly says, love and hugs to you both. And his question is, he says, please ask Kevin about the carbon nanotubes created in a thermitic reaction, sorry about that, and how they were found in the lungs of first responders by Mount Sinai Hospital.
Yeah, so we just briefly, thanks for the question, Joseph, by the way. We just briefly mentioned that in looking at my blog post about it. But yeah, the researchers at Mount Sinai Hospital published an article about these carbon nanotubes showing up in lung tissue from the first responders, and they didn't have an explanation. They couldn't see how that could that occur. And so, you know, it was speculated that maybe just the fires, the office fires, would create these carbon nanotubes. But the fact is that the carbon nanotubes require very specific conditions. They require very high temperatures, not the temperatures that are seen in normal office fires. They require metal catalysts of a specific kind, and the specific kinds just happen to be the kinds that are found in thermitic materials.
Oh.
Yeah. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that lead us to believe that it must have been a thermitic reaction. So, you know, Dr. Herod and I took the residues from some of the nanothermite materials that I created and tested them. So he had them tested at the University of Copenhagen to see if they contain these single-walled carbon nanotubes that were being found in the same kinds that were being found in lung tissue at the first responders. And they did find that, those. And then he and I took, we pitched in and we sent samples to another independent lab. And again, they found that single-walled carbon nanotubes of the variety that were found in the lung tissue of first responders were scattered throughout the World Trade Center dust. And so, you know, we believe that it's the reaction of the nanothermite materials that created these single-walled carbon nanotubes, and that they would not have been created otherwise. And it's another indicator of, you know, the explosive demolition of the World Trade Center buildings. And it's an indicator that may lead us to helping the first responders figure out their health problems.
Wow. Okay. Gail?
Awesome. All right. Next question is from, one moment, please, is from Irina. She says, to what degree do you feel that the judicial system is probably already infiltrated and compromised? We haven't had success there in all these 20 years. How could it be different now and into the future? Is there any hope in that direction? Are there any other ways besides pursuing legal action?
Well, yeah, it's a great question. I can't necessarily speak to the infiltration of the judicial system. I don't know how much infiltration is actually required because, you know, selection of justices is based on their ability to go along with certain things, I think. You know, it's similar for professions anywhere. You know, people like myself, if we speak out in ways that embarrass the company or embarrass the authorities, then, you know, we're not likely to be employed in that position for much longer. But the better question, the follow-up from Irina, again, thank you, Irina, but the follow-up, are there ways to make our judicial system, the way I hear it is our judicial system in the United States, work for 9/11 truth? I think there are ways. Personally, I don't necessarily think that another federal government investigation of 9/11 will help us, not in the United States, although it may help us in some of the many other countries where victims originated from. However, I think particularly with regard to these suspects, I feel like, you know, if charges can be brought, and they can be brought against specific people, for example, people lied to Congress during the investigations of 9/11. Two examples were the head of NORAD, the commander of NORAD, Ralph Eberhardt, lied to Congress about notifications that NORAD had received or not received about the hijacked planes. And George Tenet, the director of the CIA, lied about the CIA's knowledge of the hijackers. He lied to Congress about the existence of torture videos that his agency later destroyed. And I feel like if these individuals were pursued legally, I personally feel like they would not receive the same protections and that the federal government as a whole would receive in terms of 9/11 as a crime.
Mm. Excellent. Gail? Is there another question, Gail?
Yes, sorry. This question is from Lynn. He says, Kevin, are you inclined that the original flights 11 and 175 were the ones that were flown into the towers?
Yes, I think they were. Now, you know, there's a lot about the flights that needs to be understood. I would like to see, for example, their flight maintenance records, because as I said, the history of their maintenance may be related and helpful in the hypothesis that many of us have that the planes were taken over remotely. They were hijacked remotely. And so I think the maintenance records of those planes are very relevant to following up on the hypothesis. But yes, I believe Flight 11 and Flight 175 hit the World Trade Center towers.
So you don't think the planes were switched out? Have you seen some of that theory and evidence that's been put forth for that theory?
I've seen some of it early on. And, you know, frankly, two things is the evidence I've seen is not terribly convincing. But also, the hypothesis doesn't lead me to understand why. I mean, what if Flight 11 and Flight 175 could be hijacked and flown into the buildings, and they could, as we've discussed, remotely, then there's no reason to play a game with switching planes or worrying about what happened to the passengers, which, you know, leads to emotional discussions that just don't add to the pursuit of justice, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a good point, Kevin. Okay.
All right, we have a question from Michael. He says, what best explanations have been proposed for the selective damage to vehicle blocks away from the WTC, which some have ascribed to energy weapons?
Yeah, thank you, Michael. So, yeah, this is a great line of inquiry in terms of the fact that vehicles around the World Trade Center complex and the blocks around the World Trade Center complex were being set on fire or exploding in some way on the day of 9/11, you know, as the buildings were collapsing or afterward. And so, you know, personally, I see no evidence whatsoever for directed energy weapons. I think that's already been thoroughly debunked. And, you know, if you don't know that, you should go to the Journal of 9/11 Studies and take a look at some of the work by Dr. Gregory Jenkins, a physicist from the University of Maryland, Arabesque, and James Gourley, for example, have all written about that and really thoroughly debunked the directed energy weapons hypothesis. But, you know, what could have happened? You know, one thing I think we need to keep in mind and just always go back to is that the people who committed these crimes, they knew we were going to ask questions about that. They knew there were going to be people who would figure out something wasn't right. And I think they anticipated and put in place things that would divert attention. And I think this could be one of those things. However, I think it's very obvious. I've written about it myself, that vehicles in places that weren't really exposed to the plane impacts or the damage, the debris falling necessarily, were set on fire, were exploding. For example, a firefighter years after 9/11 sent me photos, detailed photos of the underground parking garages of the World Trade Center before they collapsed. So they were in there taking photos, and they had all these photos of these vehicles that were burned to a crisp and damaged. And so, you know, how that could have happened? Well, personally, I think in the buildings, they could have been burned through the explosions that people like William Rodriguez have talked about, and incendiary materials. But outside in the areas around the World Trade Center, I think there might have been people who were setting off materials in these vehicles. I don't know for a fact, and maybe it all was debris. But, you know, these vehicles were towed far away from, in many cases, far away from where they originally were at. So there's a little bit of uncertainty about where they exactly were at. And I think that the fires could be in the vehicles could be explained to some degree by the debris. or the explosions that were occurring. But I think there also is a possibility that somebody was doing something to try to divert our attention.
Good point.
Personal opinion.
Yeah. All right. This next question is from Gene. He asks, do Richard and Kevin think the core columns were cut and the building unzippered, if you will, or do they think something was engineered at the perimeter columns as well?
You first, Kevin.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think the core columns were compromised through the use of thermite and also as necessary other explosives. I think core columns were damaged. Now, exactly how that occurred, I haven't seen too many. There was a pretty good analysis of that. I'm trying to think of the fellow's name who talked about this. And, you know,
Gordon Ross.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you. Scottish guy. Gordon Ross did a great analysis of this. And, you know, he even took into account the spire that was still standing for a short period and then fell. But yeah, I think the evidence suggests that the core columns were destroyed through thermite and also through explosives of some sort or cutting devices. So that's my opinion on the core columns.
Even FEMA, before NIST took over that investigation in 2002, FEMA had documented very well that the antenna came down first in the North Tower. And before the perimeter comes down, well, the antenna sits on the hat truss. The hat truss sits on the core columns. Mm-hmm. So they're clearly documenting that the core columns failed first. And that's important because that's what you want to do in a controlled demolition to keep the building from kind of tipping over. You start in the core. Just like Building 7 is proven to have started in the core, all of those core columns, 24 of them in that case. So then NIST took over the investigation. They had to come up with a different scenario. So then they came up with a scenario that the floor trusses sagged and pulled in the perimeter columns, causing them to fail in their computer model all the way around the building at once, even though the fires were quite diminished at that time. Do you have any comments on that one, Kevin?
Yeah, you know, the official accounts were changing over the years. And I wrote about this early on, but, you know, they had a column failure theory. I think this Weidlinger Associates company had this official theory that the columns had all failed and that's what made the buildings collapse. And then there was the pancake theory where basically the floors alone collapsed. So it was columns alone, then it was floors alone, contradicting each other. The pancake theory was attributed really to the FEMA or as a result of the FEMA investigation. And then Popular Mechanics took that on. And then, as Richard said, the official investigation evolved again into a combination of columns and floor assemblies, where the floor assemblies were said to have sagged so much they pulled the perimeter columns inward. And that would have been an amazing feat in itself, in my opinion. But the contradictory evolving explanations really never added up. You know, the final story is what some people call a pile driver theory. So, you know, whether the core columns or the perimeter columns were pulled in or not, the fact is the large amount of steel below what happened at the impact or the initiation area was cold steel. It was not unfired. It was not compromised. And, you know, Richard's talked a lot about this over the years, but this pile driver hypothesis just doesn't add up at all.
Yeah. In fact, if the pile driver was true, Kevin, it would have destroyed those remaining core columns, the spire, because it would have driven all those down to the ground.
Yeah.
And yet they survived, proving that it wasn't the top section of building that crushed the rest of the building, as if that could be true, because it completely violates Newton's third law of equal and opposite destruction when two bodies collide.
Yeah.
Dale, is there another question for Kevin?
Yes, this one is from Susie. She asked, what about the serial numbers on the planes being grounded at different airports?
Okay, I'm not exactly sure the detail of that. The serial numbers of the planes being grounded at different airports may refer to the hijacked planes, or may refer again back to the hypothesis that planes were switched out. You know, but with regard to the planes, I think the most fruitful next step for people who are interested in the planes and how they might have been involved, yeah, I think that we need to continue to pursue the idea of the maintenance records of these aircraft, because, to some extent, we would have to be able to say that a limited number of people were involved in the crimes. That it didn't involve everybody who did maintenance on the aircraft. Didn't involve everybody who worked for American and United Airlines. But there are certain things that could have happened in a certain sequence where the maintenance of the planes could have occurred at a certain location and been associated with the remote control of the planes, technology added to those planes. Related to the potentially even homing devices to exactly where the planes should or were intended to hit the buildings. So I think those are things that should be first followed up. I'm not really sure what the serial number specifically question is about.
Yeah, me either. But if Susie, if you want to clarify that, go ahead and do that.
Okay. This is another good question from Susie that a lot of people may not know the answer to, and that is the nanothermite only produced in military labs?
Well, yeah, good question. So the when we started looking into this Sol-Gel nanothermite material, you know, where we first saw it was at national laboratories run by the Department of Energy. So Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories, for example, Los Alamos National Laboratory. This is where this high-tech research was being done. So not necessarily military labs per se, although there's association between the Department of Energy and the U.S. military. I mean, so the question is, could a lot of people said, where could this have been made? And I gave an example in my garage that I could make it. You know, it does help that I'm a chemist, so I understand the formulation. I understand how these things can be done. And I was able to obtain the materials, which isn't always possible. But nanothermite comes in different flavors and formulations, and it could be made in other places beyond the Department of Energy or military lab. It just takes some know-how and access to the right materials.
All right. Great answer. Okay. So we have another question. This is from, this is from Gregory. And he asked, Ryan, what's your take on calling mercury leaking light bulbs green?
Mercury leaking light bulbs green. I'm not sure what that means. Maybe a clarification would help on that. I'm not sure what that question means.
Okay, and let's see, maybe he can comment and clarify that. I think he's just referring to what is your opinion about calling mercury light bulbs green.
Okay, I think I get it now. Okay. The idea is the bulb is being sold as a green alternative, right? So, and if it's leaking mercury, how could that be a green alternative? Well, if I understand the question, doesn't that maybe not a lot of connection to 9/11, although maybe I misunderstood. Is it environmentally friendly to have mercury leaking light bulbs? If that's the question, I would say, no, it's not environmentally friendly. Mercury is a toxin. And maybe it has something to do with 9/11 that I'm not really aware the question.
I have a question, Kevin. There are those who suggest that nuclear weapons brought the towers down. Do you have a response on that?
Yeah, a good thorough review of that was done by Dr. Stephen Jones back in 2007, and it's available at the Journal of 9/11 Studies. So I think the article is called Hard Evidence Repudiates the Mini Nuke Theory or something like that. Anyway, if nuclear weapons were used at the World Trade Center, and there's no reason to believe they were at this time, there would be fingerprints, much like the elemental fingerprint of the microspheres that we found throughout the World Trade Center dust. There would be radioactive fingerprints. So there would be a lot of, for example, tritium in the water And so Dr. Jones goes through this. It turns out that Dr. Jones, as a nuclear physicist, is quite well qualified to answer this question because he knows nuclear reactions better than most people do. But he went through the USGS data, for example, and found that, you know, the data does not support the idea of the products of nuclear reactions occurring at the World Trade Center. So, you know, nuclear reactions certainly produce a lot of energy. Would they have explained the exact phenomenon physically is one question. But more importantly, there must be, if they occurred, there must be radioactive residues of those reactions, and there doesn't appear to be.
Gotcha. Okay, Gail, is there any others? Because we're going to be running out of time pretty soon.
Well, so you did ask Susie to clarify, so she did, and I'll read her clarification. She says, the planes that were claimed to have hit the buildings, their serial numbers were identified on grounded, in parentheses, taken out of operation. So were identified after they were taken out of operation, after 9/11 at a different airport.
Meaning that the parts that were found at the site don't match with the planes that were said to have hit the towers? That's what I'm guessing she's saying. What do you think, Kevin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd have to take a look at that evidence. I haven't seen a lot about that. But again, you know, sometimes we have to ask ourselves, are we, you know, is this adding to the discussion? Because there's no real reason to believe that the planes would need to be switched, right? I don't see the benefit of that to the operation.
Well, let me provide one benefit.
Yeah.
Some pilots say you can't hit a 200-foot wide target at 500 miles an hour with a civilian aircraft. It would have had to have been a military aircraft that was much more sophisticated and perhaps painted like one of the others. I've heard that argument.
Yeah, and that's just not true. The fact is the remote control technology that was able to control these large airliners could pinpoint, they could hit two windows in that building with this remote control technology. Oh. So it was so good to the, you know, the fact that, you know, when we discussed the Pentagon hit the first floor of the building flying at 500 miles per hour. Now, a human pilot probably couldn't do that, but remote control technology is amazing at the time it was being developed. And I think there was 9/11 was somewhat of a demonstration of that technology, in my opinion. So remote control technology would take away the pilot's decision-making altogether and, you know, be something that could be done from these E-4 planes that were flying above the Washington and in these areas. And so these military control planes, AWACS, for example, I think they're also called, they could be flying these other airliners through remote control, and they absolutely could hit any target they needed to.
Okay, and I guess that puts you on record as one of those who believe that a large plane did hit the Pentagon.
Well, not exactly, but true. You know, it's similar. So this, I don't mean to make things too twisted for everybody to understand, because there's been a lot of effort to try to turn the questions about the Pentagon into that one question of whether a plane hit the building or not. That's not even close to the portraying the questions about the Pentagon correctly, of which there are dozens of unanswered questions. But my personal opinion is that the plane did hit the construction trailers right outside the building.
Oh.
So the plane hit the exact location where the building had just been renovated by a company called AMAC Construction. Which went on to clean up the site at the Pentagon and also clean up the site at the World Trade Center. But these construction trailers were right outside the impact zone. And I personally believe, and as I've written in an article called From Renovation to Revolution, Was the Pentagon Attacked from Within? I've explained that these trailers were the perfect site to deploy homing parts of the remote control technology, the equipment needed to bring the plane right in exactly to where they wanted it to be. So I'm a person that kind of standing in between the planes and the no planes argument.
Oh, interesting.
I think the plane did not hit the building. I think the plane hit the construction trailers right outside the building.
Wouldn't there be debris outside the building if that were the truth?
Yeah, possibly, but also, you know, the use of explosives is part of my hypothesis as well.
Oh, okay, interesting. Well, thank you. I think that's all the time we have questions for. Gail, is there any hot burning questions there? We can deal with one more.
Let's see. Maybe? Well, there are a few more, but if you just want one, it's hard to pick, but I can give you one last question from Steve. He says, this may be directed more at you, though, Richard. Did AE 9/11 Truth ever take a look at the building performance report, excuse me, for the Pentagon that NIST was a part of, or is that still on an off, excuse me, an off-topic censored subject at AE 9/11 Truth?
This is an interesting accusation that we censor that subject. I would have to say there's several reasons that while I was at AE 9/11 Truth, we avoided the topic because it was one a source of acrimony between at least three major competing factions who believe that they all have the evidence that shows what did or didn't hit the Pentagon. By the way, we're going to take this subject on and invite those three factions and maybe the Kevin Ryan faction, if you will. This is a new one for me, Kevin, and I'm going to read your article and learn more about the Pentagon before I invite yourself, Barbara Honegger, Craig McKee, David Chandler, Wayne Costi, on to describe their evidence in detail and not have a free-for-all, at least not at first. Maybe we'll have an open debate after each of them get to present their cases on this new platform where I am now unleashed from the quote, censored topic, unquote, over at AE. A better reason is that we avoided that topic was because we have absolute solid scientific forensic evidence for the destruction of the World Trade Center. And the evidence giving rise to all these different factions is not as clear and concise to the 9/11 Truth movement, much less to the public. So we want to wake the public up, the scientists, the academic institutions, the professional associations, our elected representatives, to the best proof that we've been lied to at 9/11. And that clearly is the World Trade Center. So that's why we stuck with that evidence. Now that I am unleashed, we're going to stretch our wings a little farther. And when I'm ready, we'll take that issue on. Kevin, do you have any comments about any of that?
No, not really. It's not, you know, that question specifically is not a great deal of interest to me, whether a plane hit the building or didn't. I think there's so many other questions that need to be answered related to the Pentagon that I feel like the discussion itself is somewhat of a diversion.
Yeah. So thank you for mentioning that. Now, where can people learn more about your efforts and your previous articles, Kevin?
Well, at my blog, digwithin.net, of course, at the Journal of 9/11studies.com. At 9/11 Blogger, I had an older historical blog. You can also contact me at my blog has a contact email address available at the About section.
Digwithin.net in the About section. You can contact Kevin yourself if you have more questions for him. Thank you, Kevin, for being such an incredible and informative guest on the show today. And thank you, Gail, for helping me so much. I want to thank everybody for joining us and for the great questions today. We'll be back next week with Captain Dan Hanley of the 9/11 Pilots Whistleblowers. And so stay tuned for that and learn more at our website, richardgage911.org.
I would like to just add really quick that in the beginning, there was a huge response, requesting that Kevin returns on our podcast. Everybody would like to hear from him again.
Oh, we'll have you back, Kevin, if you're willing. We kept you overtime today, but we do apologize for that. And maybe next time we'll keep you even longer. Who knows?
Well, thank you both and best of luck.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Thanks, everybody. And bye for now.
Visit us at richardgage911.org, where you can find our schedule, learn about the WTC evidence, and of course, sign up for our emails and support us. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.